Good morning, everyone. We have been worshiping. We've come to worship together today as a community, young and old. And we try to do that once a month because we believe it's important for us as children and teens at times and people a little bit older than that to come together and to worship together, to be together, to share communion together. And I think that's an important part of who we are as a family, as a community who are together. And so we do that so that kids feel that they have a safe space here in this place where they can be together with grown-ups and learn more about what it means to worship God and to follow God. And for those of us who are grown-ups, to catch some of the joy and the creativity and the spark that some of the younger ones bring. So we're glad to be able to be here this morning. Now, some of you may wonder what happens in this building on Sunday mornings outside of this room. Well, my name is Brian Peterson, in case you weren't aware of that, and I'm one of the pastors here. And I spend a lot of time with those children on Sunday mornings. And so I just wanted to give you a quick update on what's been going on over the past few months, for example, in as we meet down the hallways of this building. So for example, the last few months, we have explored how kids can come to get to know more about God through nature, through the scriptures, through science and art. We've learned some new songs as ways to worship God and getting into some music. We've made and delivered Get Well cards to those who are having a rough time. We've raised some money for kids in Ipala for their lesson books and learned about some of the challenges of learning and going to school there in Guatemala. We've discovered new ways of connecting with God through imaginative prayer and other kinds of practices. We've had some good amount of meaningful conversations in small groups with our leaders, talking about things like bullying or things that make us afraid. Talking about being peacemakers or caring for the creation, caring for those in need. And lots of talk about God's love and about what it means to follow Jesus. We get to practice every week how to get along with kids who are different than us and have different kinds of personalities. And that's always a good learning experience, right? And needs. We've sent encouragement cards to hurricane victims in Houston. And we've played our share of silly games as well, just to add some fun. We do that because we think that children who come here are worth investing in. And we believe that our kids deserve to have a vision of a loving and lovable God. And they deserve to be inspired to be agents of love, peace, and hope in our world. And as we do that, and because we believe that, it really takes an engagement, an investment for all of us as we carry out that ongoing opportunity to be with and nurture our children. Part of that, and we've been talking about this a little bit during the Lent season, how financially committing to Cedar Ridge, today we're going to talk just a little bit about how that impacts our children. For one, we do pay our staff here, and for primarily me in terms of children's ministry, but I also collaborate with Ruth and Matthew we put together and create lessons that align with our values, that with our approach to following Jesus, and we really consider that a long-term investment in their lives and their spiritual health. And so that's important to us. We feel that what we do on Sunday mornings is important, but as parents and caregivers, your role or the parents' roles are so hugely important in a child's spiritual growth, right? And so one of the ways that we try to support that, and it might be a small way, but we try to provide, we purchase books or videos that can be resources that help nurture faith in a child. And we have a small little mini library for parents out in the commons. You're welcome to stop by and browse and borrow some of those resources. Now, because our kids have a variety of learning styles and energy levels and spiritual awareness, we are committed to providing engaging, creative, hands-on, experiential type of activities, and it can sometimes cost some money for supplies and materials. All of that are just different ways that we invest in the well-being of our kids. So we really appreciate those of you who support the work of Cedar Ridge. And if you're not doing so yet, we encourage you to do that and consider it an investment in the next generation. And actually this Lent, some of our kids are participating in Coins for Lent, which is a way that they too can learn a little bit about generosity during this season. There's also kind of a personal investment that is involved and can be involved. We have about 65 infants, toddlers, preschoolers, and elementary age kids who come at least once a month to Cedar Ridge. And we feel that in order to really be able to provide an experience that is good for them, an enjoyable one, one that is the best relational setting for them, to have some meaningful conversations, to have a safe space where they can get together, we are at a point where we need some more leaders and helpers in that role. I think that's especially true for our elementary group. So if you'd love to see these kids experience the love of God and connect in a way that we are trying to connect here to Cedar Ridge and our vision, I'd invite you to talk to me, find me, stop by the desk in the commons after a service, talk to any of our elementary leaders that you maybe see over here and say, hey, what's that all about, or other workers. And they can share with you the truth, the honest truth about what goes on on Cedar Ridge Kids on Sunday. And so for those of you who are already serving, those of you who are already giving, I thank you, but I know our kids thank you. We appreciate having adults, grown-ups, who are willing to come alongside of us in this journey and being a part of this community. Now, speaking of kids, there are a couple of helpers that I have this morning that are going to help us introduce communion. So I think I see this is your cue. Hannah, James, Patrick, Aaliyah, Isaac, come on down. All right. So thank you. All right. So we're going to look out this way, right? Now, as these guys come, we know that during the end of Jesus' life, he got together with 12 of his closest friends, right? We call them disciples sometimes. And he had a very important meal with them. And while he was sharing amongst all the food that was there, he had some bread and he had a cup of drink. And he said, whenever you take this, I want you to remember how much I love the world. And so he said, whenever you take this bread and drink this juice and you come together as a people, you're remembering me. You're remembering Jesus and all that Jesus is for us. And so on that Last Supper, as we sometimes call it, Jesus had some bread, right? And he took that bread. And what he said is, this is, just think of this like my body. And he broke it. And he gave it to his friends, and they passed it around. Gave him some bread. And you can take some off and pass it down to your buddies, all right? You want to pass it out to Aaliyah? Share that? Sharing is a good thing. And then he took the cup, and he said, this is like forgiveness and love poured out for you. And so whenever you come together and take this bread and drink this juice, we're remembering Jesus and how much Jesus loves us, all right? So in a moment, everyone here is going to have an opportunity to receive some bread, some gluten-free bread and some juice at the tables up front in the center and then with the servers on the sides. There are also some other acts of worship that you might want to respond with, and you can see those listed on the screens. And so this is an opportunity for all of us, young and old, as parents see fit, to participate in communion together. And so before we do that, Aaliyah is going to lead us in a prayer. She's going to read, and then I'll have everyone respond with her. All right?
Good morning, God. It's so good to come together today, young and old, to remember Jesus. Thank you for the life, forgiveness, joy, and safety we find in Jesus.
Fill us up with your love to everyone around us. Thanks. Let's receive communion together.
I wonder if my life could really change at all. All this earth, all that is lost, ever be found? Could a garden come up? Springing up from the soil ground, out of chaos life is being found in you. You make beautiful.
You make beautiful things. You make beautiful things. Out of the dust, you make beautiful things. You make beautiful things out of the.
You make beautiful things.
You make beautiful things. You make beautiful things out of the dust. You make beautiful things. You make beautiful things out of us.
Beautiful things. You make beautiful.
Hi, everybody. Okay, so we're at the point now where, kids, you're going to head out to your program. So elementary age, you're going to head out this way. Preschool, out this way. So if you want to start making your way out, that would be great. Why don't you just take another 30 seconds, chat to the person next to you or behind you. Anybody who's, because some people came in a little later, but you may have somebody new behind you. Just take a moment to say hello, and then we'll regroup in a second. Okay, so my name's Matthew, by the way. I'm the lead pastor here, so I want to welcome everybody. You made it through the storm. Who does not have power? Anybody not have power back home? So you've come in to recharge batteries and get your cell phone charged up. I know. I did the same thing. Okay, want to let you know about a few things coming up over the next few weeks. Firstly, just want to welcome you if you're new. We're so glad you're here, and there's a bunch of different things that go on here that are sort of especially designed to make it easy for you to connect with us. We'd love to find out a little bit about you. You can do that by checking out the flyer. You probably got one of these when you came in this morning. Information there about different events and things going on, and on the back page you'll see there's a space to fill out your name and details. You can tear that off, drop it in one of those wooden towers at the back, in front of the doors at the back there, or at the baskets at the side. You can also text the information to us, and we'd love to follow up with you. We'd love to meet you and chat with you too, and right after the service at the back there in that corner, we'll have something called Cedar Ridge in 7 minutes. We'll share some information about our church with you. We have a small gift for you too, answer any questions you have. So do come along and see us afterwards as well. We've just also got our new quarterly newsletter. Comes out every quarter, believe it or not. And this is our sort of Lent version. We're in the middle of Lent at the moment, so do check that out too. That's a great way to get familiar with our community. There's some articles in there from different people in our community. Again, information about things that are going on at the moment as well. So grab a copy of that. You can get that online, or there's hard copies out in the on the welcome desk too. So check those out. Okay, a few events coming up that I want to let you know about briefly. March the 9th, so that's this coming Friday, we have our gathering, I guess, what are we calling it? It's a sort of like a little workshop, a discussion. It's called The Heart of Immigration, right? And we're going to have, there's a really powerful documentary we're going to show, or clips from that. We're going to have some interaction. There'll be a panel. We're going to have some guests here too. There's childcare, and it's going to be a really wonderful interactive evening around a crucial issue for us in our culture at the moment as we seek to be, as followers of Jesus, those who include others, include the stranger, include people who are vulnerable. And obviously that's kind of a very topical issue right now. So come along on Friday for that discussion. I mentioned there's childcare, and we also have some flyers for it. So grab one of these flyers. These are out on the information desk. And just grab one for your own benefit. It's got all the details there. But you may want to take a few of these and use them to invite friends. You could stick them up in your local Starbucks, your local supermarket. Ask permission to do that, obviously. Just let people know a little bit about that, because we're wanting it to be something open to our local community. So you can help us get the word out that way. Also, we are, as I mentioned, we're in the middle of Lent. And today, at long last, our Lenten challenge group starts. So we have four different groups, simplifying life, and you can see the room numbers there. So if you know what group you want to be in, and you've already signed up for that, just check out. We'll remind you at the end too. But the simplifying life, being authentic, becoming a safer person, and reducing marginalization. Okay, those are the challenge groups, and we're encouraging everybody to get into a challenge group, and you'll follow that same group through for 3 weeks. So they begin today, and they will run after the service for the next three Sundays. We've got the journey up there too. So the journey is a description, or a sort of an investigation of what we're all about as a church. It will also run for 3 weeks after each of these services. I just want to invite you to come along to that if you want to find out more about our church. Just simple as that. You just want to find out a little bit more. It's a more in-depth, obviously, discussion about Cedar Ridge than Cedar Ridge in 7 minutes. But especially if you're thinking about committing here, if you're thinking that, okay, I think this is where I want to make my spiritual home, really encourage you to come along so we can get to know you a bit better. You can get to know us, ask whatever questions you have, and really think through what it means to be part of this community. So that's the journey, which will be after the service as well. I think that's pretty much it. We've got a couple of Lent things I wanted to remind everybody about. We have the Quiet Day on the 24th. That's March 24th, a Saturday. And there's information about that in the flyer you can check out. Specifically, remember that you don't have to come for the whole day for that. So there's a section in the middle there from noon till 2, which will be particularly geared to people who just want to give a couple of hours. So you know, if you can come for the whole day, great. That's it'll be over in the barn. But if you've got want to go come for 2 hours, come along at noon, because the program kind of is set up that way for new people coming in at that point. And then the 25th of March, so the last Sunday of this month, will be Palm Sunday. And we've sort of made it a bit of a tradition now where that Palm Sunday is also, at the end of Lent, a commitment Sunday. So that means we'll be dedicating babies, we'll be receiving new people into membership of the church, and we'll be baptizing people. So if you want to participate in that kind of way, we'll be doing some other things as well in that service, but if you want to, if you have a child you'd like to dedicate, or dedicate yourself as a parent, if you want to join the church, become a member, if you do, by the way, you know, encourage you to come along to the journey if you haven't done that already, or you want to get baptized, come and see me or anybody else on the pastoral staff, right? You'll see our pastoral team are listed out on the back of the flyer with all the emails. You can email that person, or if you know somebody on the pastoral team, just come and chat with us, and we'll get your details and get you all set up for that service on the 25th. Okay, I think that is about it. So Ruth is going to come up and lead us on in the next session of our Lent series. Thanks, Ruth.
Don't need all that. Good morning. My name's Ruth. I'm one of the pastors here. And this is the third week in our series, Creating Safe Space. So this week, we want to look at creating safe space to be our authentic selves. And I want to start with two very different stories. The first is about a woman called Ellen Craft. I think we have a picture of her. She was born in 1826. She was the enslaved daughter of a white slave owner and his biracial slave. So her complexion was very pale, and she was often mistaken for a member of the slaveholder's family, much to the annoyance of the slaveholder's wife, who really resented Ellen. And so she gave her away as a wedding present to her daughter, so to Ellen's half-sister, when she was 11 years old. Ellen grew up, she married William Craft, and they both lived in Macon, Georgia, and they were held in slavery by two different masters. And they were terrified of being separated, particularly William. William had seen both his parents be sold off separately and his siblings too, and so he was determined that they weren't going to start a family under those conditions. So they came up with a very ingenious plan to escape from Georgia and go 1,000 miles to Philadelphia. The light-skinned Ellen cut her hair short and dressed up as a young man. She actually also, Stick with that one for a while. She'd also put bandages around her face so that people wouldn't see how smooth her skin was. So she dressed up and pretended to be an injured white rich man, and William, her husband, played the role of her devoted black manservant. And so on December the 21st, 1848, the Crafts put on their disguises and boarded a train to start this long journey north. And it seemed like it was going to be a disaster right from the start. Ellen sat down, and the guy sat down next to her was actually a friend of the family and had been at the house just 2 days earlier, and actually knew Ellen pretty well. But he didn't see through the disguise, and so she pretended to be deaf for the next 2 hours till he got off. So they spent the next several days traveling by train and by steamer throughout the South, lodging in these fancy hotels. She had to, you know, keep up this pretense of being a rich white man. She had to come up with all kinds of excuses for why she couldn't drink brandy and why she couldn't smoke cigars with the rest of the men. People kept looking at her with a bit of suspicion, you know, something doesn't seem right here. William, meanwhile, people tried to buy him. Abolitionists tried to take him away. One woman thought that he was her escaped slave and tried to have him recaptured. Since Ellen couldn't read or write, she put her arm in a... Go back, James! Back, back! trying to hurry me through this story, right? But it's a good story, so I'm going to tell it all. So she put her arm in a bandage so that she wouldn't have to sign any papers because she couldn't read or write. And then they got stuck in Charleston because she wouldn't sign for the tickets. But then fortunately, the captain from the ship previously came by and said, "No, I know this young man. He's a fine young man." And they got on the ship. So finally they made it to Baltimore, and they were stopped by the border patrol, and it seemed like it was total, that's it, you're stopped, because Ellen didn't have papers to prove that she owned William. And they were insistent, you're not going. And so they stood there and prayed for what just seemed like forever. And then suddenly the train bell rang to say the train was leaving. And the man, for whatever reason, just said, "Well, it's a shame, such an injured man. Oh, go on." And on they got onto the train. And they arrived in Philadelphia on Christmas morning. And as they left the station, Ellen burst into tears and cried out, "Thank God, William, we're safe. Now you can go to the..." James. "No, back. Thank you. Stop. I'll give you a hands up when you can go on." Okay, so finally they thought they were safe. Actually, they weren't safe, and they continued. People kept trying to capture them because the story was so sensational. People came, and they fled in the end to England. And there they are in later life in England, where they raised a family. And this is a really exciting story. You can read this story actually online in, next one, William's book. It's a short book describing their escape. It's very exciting. It's free online. It's called Running 1,000 Miles to Freedom. I'd really recommend it, because there's lots of other incidents that happen along the way. But the reason I'm telling this story, other than Ellen is my absolute hero, the reason I'm telling this story is because of this idea of pretense. I can only imagine what it felt like, those 5 days of being on the run, of having to keep up this pretense, particularly for Ellen, of having to pretend to be a white, upper-class man, knowing the consequences if she was found out, the incredible, barbaric, what would have happened to them, to her and to the man she loved if they had been found out. Clearly, they weren't free to be themselves. The second story is shorter and very, very different. Couldn't be more different, really. This is a story from The Crown. So I'm not 100% sure it's true, but I did check on the made-up stories in The Crown, and it wasn't in that list. So I'm pretty sure this happened. So this is Queen Elizabeth. She's taking a tour of the Commonwealth, and she's spending weeks and weeks just smiling and waving. And she ends up in Australia experiencing facial muscle spasms. And the doctors tell her, "Well, the cure is stop smiling for a while." And she says, "The trouble is, I have the sort of face that if I stop smiling, everyone says, isn't she cross?" So instead, she opts for muscle relaxants in her face, and she goes back to smiling. And although we're probably not touring around with thousands of adoring crowds, this story is probably a little bit closer to how some of us may feel. We're not pretending in order to stay alive like Ellen and William Craft were. But at the same time, it might sometimes feel like we have to constantly have this mask. We have to pretend and put on a brave face on things. We have to hold things together. Maybe we're the one who always needs to be confident or the fun person or the reliable person or whatever it is that we feel that we have to be. That we may think, that's not who I really am. That's not who I feel I am inside. We have this pressure to perform. And keeping up that mask can be exhausting and painful and stressful. Now, all of us pretend to be what we're not sometimes. And that's not always bad, right? We're looking at creating safe space to be our authentic selves, to be where we can let down our guard, where we can stop pretending. But we're not going to be like that all the time with everyone, right? There's a difference between authentic and real and being totally unfiltered. We probably all know some people who are unfiltered, right? Those are those people that you say good morning to, but you never say, "How are you?" Because they'll tell you, right, in great detail whether or not it's appropriate. Or unfiltered people are those kind of people who say, "Well, I'm in a bad mood, so deal with it," you know, or "I'm just being real," as though that's an excuse for just kind of letting it all out. I mean, we all have our bad moods, but, you can be appropriate. So that obviously this is not what we're talking about. Filters definitely have their place. We need to be appropriate. But inauthenticity, that pressure to conform to expectations or to pretend to be something we're not goes much deeper than that. It gets to the very core of who we really think that we are. Now, perhaps all of us, to some extent, live with a fear of exposure as people who are not who we think we should be. We think that if people really knew how we really are, what we're really like, maybe they wouldn't love us or value us or want us. And this fear of exposure sometimes comes through in dreams. I don't know if you've ever had that dream where everything seems kind of normal and then suddenly you realize that you're naked or you're semi-naked. Has anyone had that dream? You're lying. I Googled this because I don't want to say this and then you'll be like, she's got issues, right? So I Googled it and it is extremely normal. It's a very normal dream. So if you've never had it, it's you that's not normal. It's not me. But I have this dream quite a bit, actually. Maybe I shouldn't admit that. But it's very normal. It's a fear of exposure. We worry about being found out. Or another dream is you suddenly find that you're taking an exam in a course that you forgot to take. Does anyone have that one? Oh, see, you'll admit to that one. All right. So, I left college 20-plus years ago. I still have that dream. I have that one a lot. We fear that we're going to be found out as frauds, as ignorant people, that you know, without our metaphorical clothing, or when we're caught off guard, when we haven't studied up, we'll be exposed. People will see us for who we really are, and the results will be shameful and humiliating, and it will just be awful. The one who knows us best, of course, is God. God who created us, God who knows us intimately, knows into our very soul, God who is one with us. David was a king in ancient Israel. He, as well as being a king, he was a musician and a songwriter. And there are a number of psalms in the Bible that are ascribed to David. Now, whether David actually wrote them or whether they're in the style of David, we don't really know. But I want to read a couple of passages from two psalms that are psalms of David. So the first one is in Psalm 139. It says, "You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely." So God knows us. God knows us intimately, even better than we know ourselves. So there's no point in pretending with God. We can't fool God that we're anything except what we really are. And then the other psalm is this one. "As a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. For he knows how we are formed. He remembers that we are dust. The life of mortals is like grass. They flourish like a flower of the field. The wind blows over it and it's gone, and its place remembers it no more. But from everlasting to everlasting, the Lord's love is with those who fear him, and his righteousness with their children's children, with those who keep his covenant and remember to obey his precepts." So God knows everything about us, knows us from the inside out, and loves us with an everlasting love. The Message version has "from ever and always," love that is ever and always. There's zero risk of exposure with God because God already knows who we are. But far from rejecting us or humiliating us, God has compassion on us. God remembers that we are mortal, that we're weak, that we are broken in many ways, that we're fragile. And God's unqualified love provides us the space we need to let down the pretense. So the psalmist, not just David, but all of the psalmists, seem to understand that there's no point in pretending with God. God knows who we are. And so recognizing that they're known and loved by God, they could stop censoring themselves and really pour out their heart. And we see that throughout the psalms. Some of the writers of the psalms express grief and pain and doubt and even the desire for revenge in very raw terms. For example, in Psalm 88, "But I cry to you for help, Lord. In the morning, my prayer comes before you. Why, Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me? From my youth, I have suffered and been close to death. I have borne your terrors and am in despair. Your wrath has swept over me. Your terrors have destroyed me. All day long, they surround me like a flood. They have completely engulfed me. You have taken from me friend and neighbor. Darkness is my closest friend." And that's the end of the psalm. Because you expect, right, but yet I will praise you, or come and rescue me, but there's not. That's how that psalm ends. It feels very real. It feels raw. It feels like, you know, the psalmist is saying, "You, God, have terrorized me. You've taken my friends away. You've made me suffer." I'm feeling. That's where I am right now. There's another kind of infamous verse. We read this actually a couple of weeks ago. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is the one who repays you according to what you have done to us. Happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. A horrible, horrible verse. You know, a desire for cruel and violent revenge. It's very ugly, very, very dark. But I think the point is that the psalmist knows this is where I am right now, God, right? So whether this is right or wrong, whether this is good or bad, this is where I am. The psalmists invite God into their feelings. They don't try and pretend that they're something that they're not. They show us that we can be totally honest with God. God knows us intimately. God loves us eternally. So we can drop the pretense and be totally real with God. We can be our authentic selves with God. Except we can only be our real authentic self with God or with ourselves if we know who we really are. Because we have many selves, right? We have the person we are at work. You know, we may have responsibilities. Perhaps we're in a leadership position and we have to be very decisive. Or with a peacemaker, and we have to kind of smooth over conflict, or perhaps with a conscientious one, the one that can be relied on to stay late and make sure everything gets done. That might be very different from whom we are at church. We might feel different pressures. Perhaps here we feel that we have to be the cheery one and the positive one, or somebody who's very deep and thoughtful, or sociable, or whatever it is that we feel those pressures are. That might be very different from what we were in the car driving to work, right? a little bit more impatient person. Somebody told me that a few weeks ago that she was in the car behind me as I came to work, as I came to church. And my first thought was, oh no, what did she see? How aggressive was I going? You know, because I don't want her to think I'm aggressive, especially if she's the chair of the board. and I think social media can highlight that kind of disconnect between our different selves. I posted a picture of myself with my family one Saturday night a few weeks ago. We were at a punk concert, and there were a few comments the next morning about, oh, I didn't really see you as, you know, being there. We have different expectations of people. Actually, somebody offered me $20 to spike my hair when I spoke next. I didn't do that. But For many of us, I think one of the big pivots is when we go back to the family that we grew up in. We might feel their pressures to conform to the person we used to be when we lived there. And often that's not an easy fit. We might think, well, this is not really who I am anymore. I don't think in these ways, or I don't have those same opinions or that same way of looking at life anymore that I used to. But we have that pressure to be the kind of person we were when we lived at home. So who are we really? Psychologists talk about different ways that we develop a sense of self. And some use the term looking glass self. This is a term coined by Charles Cooley in 1902. And he describes it this way. I imagine your mind, and especially what your mind thinks about my mind, and what your mind thinks about what my mind thinks about your mind. So that's clear. No, but the idea is pretty basic. It's that our sense of self is created by what we think other people think of us. Other psychologists talk about self-categorization. So rather than believing what everybody says about us, we think in terms of groups. So I'm part of this group, but not that. And in this issue, I'm part of these group of people, not that. So we kind of create all these little groups, and that generates our sense of self. And of course, there are many, many other ideas about where does our sense of self come from. Some of that comes from inside, from the people that we think we should be, or the people that we want to be, the people we want other people to think we are, our idealized self. And some of that comes from outside. It's externally imposed on us in terms of other people's expectations. So for me, growing up, I was the smart kid. I wasn't pretty or popular or sporty or anything like that, but I was relatively smart for my age. So that was kind of my thing. That was how I saw my place in my bit of the world. And I remember being in a general knowledge competition when I was 11 or 12. And I was getting all the answers right, and it got to the last question. And the last question was, what's the number one single in the music charts right now? And everybody in the audience groaned, oh, so easy, you know, except I didn't know what it was. And I can remember it so clearly. the seconds ticking away, and all the groaning kind of turned to laughter as people realized she doesn't even know that, because when you're 12, everybody knows that. But I didn't. And I just felt totally humiliated, totally mortified. Oh my goodness, I'm meant to be the smart kid, and I don't even know that. And that was pretty much the pattern for me. I had to be right. I had to have all the answers. And if I made a mistake, my world just kind of fell apart. I was raised to have a pretty strong concept of what was right and wrong. But I remember once cheating on an exam. I only remember cheating once. And it was in phys ed, PE. Like I said, I wasn't sporty. Nobody in my family is sporty, so I didn't care what I got in PE. My teachers knew, I'm not going to the Olympics, right? She's the nerdy kid, she's going to college. I mean, they didn't really care. But for me, it was a big deal that, you know, I get straight A's, and so I need to get an A. And so I cheated in the exam when I was 13. And I was so ashamed. I think I'm still ashamed. Maybe that's why I'm sharing it in a public confession. But nothing seemed more important than projecting this image of someone who got everything right, someone with perfect grades, someone who didn't make mistakes. And if I had to cheat and feel awful about it, well, so be it. We all have a sense of self, and we protect and nurture that sense of self. And when it's challenged or threatened, I think there are a couple of ways that we often react. One is to go into denial, and the other is kind of to go into a free fall, a tailspin. In the case of denial, we cling to our sense of self, and the things that that don't fit with it, we just kind of dismiss or we rationalize away. We make excuses. I was at a painting party just recently, and it was really interesting listening to how people receive compliments. There were some people there who considered themselves to be quite autistic and to do a lot of painting. And so when someone would compliment them, they would say, oh, thank you. And, you know, even if they were self-critical, it would be like, thanks, yeah, I'm not quite happy with this bit, but I'm still working on it. But, you know, it was largely accepted. And then there were some that were there who were just like, well, I don't paint, you know, or I'm not creative. And when they were complimented, I think everybody was just completely dismissive of, oh, you're just saying that to be nice, or, yeah, well, I'm not giving up the day job. You know, those kind of things. We filter what we hear to fit with what we believe about ourselves. I'm in denial quite a few weekdays at around 3:30. I have to pick my son up from the bus stop at 3:30. And I'm often late because I always think I can get one more thing done before I leave. But this causes problems for me because I also like to think of myself as a good mother, and in my mind, a good mother puts his kids first and is always at the bus stop on time. So I deal with this by driving down at like 3:33 towards the bus stop and looking for any excuse as to why I'm late. This one may just be me. I didn't Google to see if this is normal. This is probably not normal, but you know, like if somebody pulls in front of me, I'll be like, well, it's traffic. There was so much traffic, that's why. Or if someone happens to say something as I'm leaving the building, oh, I got, you know, way late. It's not true, clearly. I just didn't leave in time. But I want to cling to this sense of I'm a good mom, and moms are there on time. It's not my fault. Now, that's a trivial example of denial. But, of course, it can be much more serious. Probably all of us know or have known a family member or a friend who's had a problem with addiction, or maybe we've had a problem with addiction. In such cases, denial can be deadly even. You know, if we cling to a view of ourselves that won't admit to what we're struggling with or what we're really dealing with, keep up that pretense, it can have profound and even tragic consequences. Denial stops us from making changes. It stops us from asking for help. But we don't necessarily go into denial when our sense of self is challenged. Sometimes instead, we just get thrown for a loop. I've told you a couple of stories about how I always needed to be right when I was a kid, because I'm hoping that you'll think, but now she's grown out of it, and she's, you know, very mature and everything. Well, I don't think I have completely grown out of the need to be right. Before I have this job at Cedar Ridge, I used to manage a multi-million-dollar global research program, and had lots of different funding streams, and it turned out that the systems to track those different funding streams was not as good a system as we all thought it was. So this project had been going on for nearly 10 years, and it got 18 more months to go. And the finance manager who supported my project came to tell me that we had run out of unrestricted funds. So we had money, but we couldn't spend it. And you know, this is with research underway in lots of different countries, lots of contractors waiting to be paid. This is lots of deliverables that we were up against the clock in the last 18 months to finish, and we were out of money. And I was totally distraught. I just couldn't believe it. Not because of the work. I was pretty sure we could get some more money, which we did. But I just thought, what does it say about me? What will people think of me that on my project this could happen? Who even am I if I'm not the person who can be counted on not to make mistakes or not to make big mistakes? At times like that, we tend to lose our sense of proportion. Instead of admitting we made a mistake, we just kind of become overwhelmed with, oh, I'm just a failure. Or if we think we're very kind people and we see something we've done that's hurtful, we just kind of, you know, oh, I'm so mean. It kind of escalates and we magnify it. Or if we're a responsible person and we realize we've let someone down, again, you know, we kind of think, oh, I'm no good to anyone. We might even start replaying past events and past conversations in our mind and thinking, oh, yeah, I'm no good. So why do we do this? Why do we project this sense of self, who we think we should be or who we believe ourselves to be? And then when it's challenged, we either deny it or we get thrown for a loop. Neither response is really very rational unless you look at what's going on beneath, the fear that underlies those kind of responses. We often have a narrative that's hidden away inside of us. I think for me, the logic's something like, well, if I make mistakes, people won't trust me with things, and then they won't need me, and then they won't want me, and then I'll be lonely and loved and probably die under a rock. Well, obviously I'm not thinking that explicitly, but I know that that narrative is deep in me, that I fear that if I don't perform, people will ultimately not love me or want me. Other people, you know, maybe think, if I'm not fun, if I'm not the life and the soul of the party, people won't want me around and I won't be loved. Or if I'm not successful, people won't respect me, my life wouldn't have meant anything, and then, you know, what's the point? Or if I can't keep everybody happy, then people will blame me and reject me, and so on. We all have those narratives that go on in our heads. So being our authentic self is difficult, I think, for two reasons. First, because it's hard to figure out who we really are. But second, because we have to kind of overcome those narratives and those fears and believe that who we really are is actually enough. It's enough to be loved. It's enough to be valued and wanted. I want us to look at an example of this from Scripture. This is a story of a guy called Jacob, who was one of two sons born to Isaac and his wife, Rebekah. So the story starts like this. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. So Jacob, he's this innocent baby. He just happens to have been born second. But being born second was a big deal, actually, in that culture at the time. It had big consequences. It was the firstborn son who was the heir. Firstborn son would receive the blessing of the father. He would be given authority in the family. He would be encouraged with words about his illustrious future. And he would be given a double share of the inheritance that was known as the birthright. Jacob missed all that by being second, by apparently just mere minutes later. It seems kind of unfair. And to add insult to injury, they named him Jacob. Now, Jacob literally means grasp the heel, so I guess that makes sense since that's what he was doing. But it was also idiomatic for deceitful. So this poor kid was not really off to a great start. Maybe they called him Jacob as kind of like a harmless family joke. Or maybe they assigned a role to him and set expectations for him right from his birth in calling him the deceiver. We don't know, but either way, Jacob grew up to live up to his name. And we see that here. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, quick, let me have some of that red stew, I'm famished. That's why he was called Edom. Edom means red. Jacob replied, first sell me your birthright. Look, I'm about to die, Esau said. What good is my birthright to me? But Jacob said, swear to me first. So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. So Esau traded away that double share of the inheritance. Not a very wise move on his part. Jacob seems to have certainly exploited the situation, but doesn't seem to have actually deceived Esau, but certainly it was that grasping nature that we heard about. But a little later on in Genesis, we see Jacob really does deceive. It's a long story, we're not going to read it all, but basically what happens, Isaac, their father, realizes he's soon going to die, and he decides he's going to give the blessing to Esau. So he tells Esau to go off and hunt, make stew, come back, and I'll give you the blessing. Off he goes. Jacob seizes the moment with his mom's help, dresses up as Esau, brings some stew to Isaac, who's blind, and pretends to be Esau so that he gets the blessing. We read that here. After Isaac finished blessing him, blessing Jacob, and Jacob had scarcely left his father's presence, his brother Esau came in from hunting. He too prepared some tasty food and brought it to his father. And he said to him, "My father, please sit up and eat of my game so that you may give me your blessing." His father Isaac answered him, "Who are you?" "I am your son," he answered, "your firstborn Esau." Isaac trembled violently and said, "Who was it then who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it just before you came and I blessed him, and indeed he will be blessed." When Esau heard his father's words, he burst out with a loud and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me too, my father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing." Esau said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? This is the second time he's taken advantage of me. He took away my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." So Esau was so incensed at Jacob, at his deceit, that Jacob feared for his life and was forced to flee. And the story continues with Jacob being deceived himself, as well as deceiving other people in order to get rich, to the point where he again has to flee for his life. So this time he flees the other way, coming back home, back towards Esau. But now they're both older men, they've grown up, they've got kids, they're married, they've got lots of livestock, they're both pretty wealthy. But Jacob wonders, is Esau still mad? Is Esau still intent on killing me? And so he divides up his party, his wives, his kids, his livestock, everything into two different groups, and sends them off thinking, if Esau attacks one of them, at least some will get away. And he's left alone, terrified about what might happen, having to face up to where his life of deception has got him. And we read this. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." So this is one of those kind of somewhat mystical stories that can be interpreted, I think, in a number of different ways. But Jacob here encounters God. He says, "I saw God face to face." That means that the man was Christ or some other representative is disputed. But for Jacob, certainly, there was a very strong sense that this was God, actually God, that he was encountering, that he was wrestling with. And in this wrestling, God asked Jacob, "Who are you? Who do you think you are?" And Jacob says, he's Jacob. He's the deceiver. He's the one who grasps, the one who takes what's not his. That's who he's always been. That's who he'll always be. But God says, "No, you're no longer Jacob. Now you're Israel." Israel means one who struggles with God. God gives him a new name, a new sense of self. God sees beyond Jacob's grasping, his deceitful nature, to his struggle, to his tenacity, to his strength of character. From birth, it seems that Jacob has been longing for more, the younger son, the second place son, the one who seemed to be cursed from birth, seems to have spent his life longing to be blessed. He'd do anything for it. He'd cheat, he'd lie, even risk his life. And he's still doing it. He says here, "I'm not going to let you go unless you bless me." There's something desperate about Jacob, something very needy. He seems very broken. He longs to be blessed. But this time he doesn't get a blessing through trickery or through pretending to be someone else. He gets it for himself, not even as Jacob, not as the person that he was named, not as the person he believes himself to be, but as the Israel, as the person he really is, the person who God says he really is. By wrestling with God, Jacob came to a deeper understanding of who he really was. And as Israel, as one who struggles with God, as his real authentic self, he was blessed. Knowing self and knowing God seem to go together. In Matthew 10, we read, Jesus says this: "If your first concern is to look after yourself, you'll never find yourself. But if you forget about yourself and look to me, you'll find both yourself and me." This connection between knowing God and knowing ourselves. David Benner, a psychologist, said this: "We do not find our true self by seeking it. Rather, we find it by seeking God. In finding God, we find our truest and deepest self. The anthropological question, who am I, and the theological question, who is God, are fundamentally inseparable. It is by losing ourselves in God that we discover our true identity." So what does it mean to lose ourselves in God? Does it mean not to be self-reflective or to ask questions about who we are, or not to try to be a better person? I don't think so, but I think it shifts the focus from us to God. We want to increasingly think and feel and believe about ourselves the things that God thinks and feels and believes about us, starting with the fact that God loves and accepts us as we are, who we really are. So we need to love and accept ourselves as we are. Now, some of us balk at that. Some of us think, well, that self-love, self-acceptance, self-compassion stuff sounds very unchristian because we're sinners. We shouldn't love ourselves. We are sinners. We're all weak. We're all broken. We all let people down. We all make mistakes. But we're not just sinners. We're also fearfully and wonderfully made. We're created in God's image. We're treasured by God. In Zephaniah, it says, God rejoices over us with singing. God is love. God calls us to love everyone, including ourselves. Because I think if you don't love yourself, it's very hard to love anyone else. We need self-compassion in order to extend compassion to others. When we recognize we're loved and treasured, even though we're broken, that we're still worth loving, we can have that same attitude towards other people and see them as broken but beautiful, made in God's image and worth loving. Self-discovery, self-compassion, self-acceptance go hand in hand with self-sacrifice. By embracing who we really are, by being honest about who we are, being authentic with God, we can accept ourselves. We can't do that if we're hiding away in shame and in self-hatred. We can only face up to those unwelcome parts of ourselves if we know we are loved and accepted. But being loved wholly and unconditionally provides us a safe space in which we can let down our guard. We can surrender our false self, our identity that we're trying to project. We can surrender that back to God. So it's by embracing ourselves we can actually be free to let go of ourselves, to give ourselves back to God. We can accept who we are now, right now, and love and accept ourselves now, but also at the same time welcome the people that we are becoming, our true God-created selves. Because we're all on a journey. We read in Corinthians, "When I was a child, I taught like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, and then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." So I see this as something of a cycle. It's as we, I think we have a slide for this, as we spend time with God, as we get to know God and see more how God views us, who we really are, we come to know ourselves and to know how much we are loved. But as we know ourselves, we can feel the safety and surrender our false identity to God and allow God to transform us more into the kind of people that we're created to be. And that drops the pretense so that we can experience more of God. So it kind of makes a cycle. And this takes honesty with ourselves. I think it's often easy for us to see falsity in other people. We know when people are faking it with us, right? I think it's often harder to tell when we're faking it. Our false self, that image that we try and project, I think is often revealed in two ways. One, by looking at our triggers. What are those things that kind of set us off? What is it that someone suggests we get very defensive about? You know, is it someone suggesting that we made a mistake, or someone suggesting that we acted without integrity, or that we're no fun? What are those things that kind of set us off? And the other thing is, what are the things that we value most, that we say, but at least I'm not X, At least I'm not incompetent, or at least I'm not boring, or at least I'm not, you know, whatever those things are. Because I think we focus on those to feel good about ourselves. We think we've got those down. So we can feel good about who we are and feel that we're better than other people. Being authentic, becoming our true selves, takes honesty with ourselves. I think it also takes honesty with others. Again, not going to be totally unfiltered, but it means being willing to be vulnerable with others, acknowledging our failures and our struggles, not just pretending we only have those successes and those strengths. It means letting go of that self that we want everybody to think that we're all so special, letting go of that and being real about the things that we struggle with. And that's risky because it may not be reciprocated. We might be actually vulnerable and say, this is who I am, and people may reject that, may not reciprocate that. But I think it's worth it. I think it's liberating to let go of the disguise, to no longer keep up that mask, but to be real with ourselves, real with others, and allow them the space and the possibility of being real with us. And we'll talk more next week about both being vulnerable and safe with other people. I want to end with this quote from Thomas Merton. "There is only one problem on which all my existence, my peace, and my happiness depend: to discover myself in discovering God. If I find God, I will find myself. And if I find my true self, I will find God." There's peace, there's happiness in discovering who we are in God. And we're going to spend a few minutes now just resting in God's presence, the God who knows us, the God who knows every little part of our lives, all the stuff that we never want anyone to see, that we don't even want to face up to ourselves. God sees that, and yet God loves us fully, always and forever. God loves us with an overwhelming, unconditional love. So we're going to just sit quietly, we're going to still our thoughts, and allow ourselves just to be who we really are when we're not pretending, when we're not striving, when we're not trying to be what we think we should be. So I encourage you to sit comfortably, close your eyes, just take a few deep breaths. Picture yourself in a place that feels safe for you. Maybe that's somewhere at home, or on a beach, forest, wherever that might be. Feel the presence of God all around you, flowing through you. Sense the light, the warmth of God's love. Know that you're loved in every little corner of your life. That God rejoices over you with singing. We're just going to take 2 minutes just to rest in that love. God of love, we thank you for your unconditional, overwhelming love for us. We thank you that you rejoice over us with singing. I pray that you would reveal more and more of yourself to us, that we would lose ourselves in you, that we would be aware of your love sinking into every corner of our being, just filling us, that we would be able to relax and to surrender who we are to you, trusting that you who made us will continue to transform us into the people that we are made to be. Thank you that you offer us a safe place where we don't need to pretend, that we don't have to perform. We can just relax in your love. And I pray that we would really sense that this week.